Good afternoon. So, last time, we finished up covering things that malware might do to evade detection and analysis. We started by talking about anti-debugging strategies that, well, if we're going to analyze a piece of malware, we're commonly going to use something like a debugger. And there are certain debugger features which, as they're typically implemented, depend on the program we're debugging, not doing certain things. One of them is breakpoints. A common way of implementing breakpoints is temporarily modifying the machine code around the breakpoint. So malware can try to, take a hash of its code to figure out, oh, was a breakpoint probably inserted here by modifying my machine code at runtime? They can also do things like time operations to see, oh, are we probably running in a debugger because things are running really slow? I guess I forgot to write the most direct way of just, ask the system, am I being debugged? Like, they can just, check that sometimes because, well, when we're talking about normal programs, that's not something you want to prohibit. I mentioned a last thing about obfuscation. I mentioned one obfuscation technique that's kind of popular and sometimes regarded as, difficult in a certain sense, where to make machine code analysis not work so well, instead of having your machine code after, some work happens, be the actual malware code, you have it be basically an interpreter for the actual malware code, like an emulator, where you make up your own little instruction set for the malware, the hope being that it just puts extra effort for whoever's analyzing your piece of software. On the other hand, it's not clear that this actually has, a defendable advantage, because, your new sort of emulator is going to implement a sort of virtual machine that, you can analyze the code for that the same way you'd analyze normal machine code. Then we also talked about sort of rootkit-type techniques, this stealth idea that, besides just evading detection by having signatures that are kind of out of whack, a more direct approach would be if you get access to a system to change things that are sort of core to the system, you can modify the programs and interfaces that you'd use to inspect. Is there a suspicious program running? Are there files here? To give a different answer. To say, no, there's no virus files in that directory. Here's my directory list. It doesn't contain that. And if you have a chance to install yourself in this way, it could be very hard to detect you. Sort of, if you do a perfect job, there's not going to be any way of detecting you because you've dealt with all the ways of inspecting for certain files or processes. And we mentioned, from a practical point of view, what do people try to do to detect this? Well, you can do signatures. You can say, well, if you've replaced my system program for listing the processes that are running, or something like that, I can try to look for the replaced version of that explicitly, or I can try to do consistency checks and see, did you miss a spot? Did you not change how processes were listed in every single place so I can detect that something's amiss? And those were the sort of ideas we had to do that, but if this sort of modification was implemented perfectly, we wouldn't have a way of knowing. Then we moved on to our next topic, or a primary topic for the next few weeks of buffer overflows and these memory error exploits. So buffer overflows, we said, well, you could write to some data in memory and go over the end of the array in memory. And we talked with this simple scenario where it seemed like we had a buffer that your input went into, and right after it was something important. And the idea is that if we provided an input that was big enough, it would overwrite something important. And it seemed like that to make this work, we had to get awfully lucky that the important thing needed to be right next to the buffer or else this wouldn't do very much. So then we moved on to talking about, well, it turns out there's usually something important next to buffers. And we started talking about a very general pattern of this, which is stack smashing, which is, well, the important thing that's next to the buffer is going to be a return address. And that's what we'll continue on talking about today. Before I move on from that to that, any questions about things we covered last time? And I have one question, logistics. So when will feedback for Tricky and Lex be released? Tricky has grades. I'm going to spot check them and hopefully release them this evening. I want to make sure that my grades and my TA's grades are consistent. And Lex, I should get graded this week because we shouldn't have to read things for it. Unlike Tricky, where we had to read some of your answers. Probably early this week for Lex. Other questions? On quiz question one, could it be scanned as run at runtime? So quiz question one this week was giving a scenario where our anti-malware software periodically scanned the memory of loaded programs. And my assumption for that was, since it was periodically, this would be while the programs were running. Because if you just choose like every hour, of course the programs are going to be running. And question, can I explain question two? So this question says that rather than having a signature that's based on the machine code, we look for a pattern of file accesses. That our signature, rather than being a pattern of bytes, is a pattern of file accesses. In that case, none of these techniques, which are designed to obscure the machine code, obscure the pattern of file accesses, so we'd expect none of them to be effective. Does that answer that question? Other questions? And I guess, for the quiz, for question one, should have accepted either answer. I should make sure that's actually done. So question is, for question two, could the polymorphic and metamorphic random open and reads that don't do anything? That is a strategy you could use that would evade this sort of signature making. That's not the sort of thing we talked about with respect to adding extra instructions and so on, because you'd have to like figure out valid files to open and so on. And wasn't the sort of extra operations we were talking about, where the code like did the same thing, it just did it in a different way or did irrelevant calculations somehow. And another question for question four, which asks, suppose we had malware that computed the hash of its machine code and data and compared it to store value, where would this likely fail? And one of the options was if it has infected a goat file. So a goat file is just meant to look like a normal executable file that something like a virus might want to infect. There's not going to be anything about it that's different than a normal executable file, because that's the point, at least not intentionally anything that's different. And because of that, if this check usually works, on a normal file, it should work on the GOAT file because there's nothing gonna not gonna be anything different about that file unless the anti-malware software manufacturer messed up. Does that answer that question? Okay. Other questions? Oh, and okay. Okay, so let's get to stack smashing then. So introduction to this, as I had said, we had some vulnerable code here. I have a buffer on the stack. I read a string into that buffer. In this case, I'm using scanf. And scanf, well, I haven't told it how big the buffer is, and it doesn't know. So it just knows you're going to get a bunch of whatever matches percent %s for scanf, which turns out to be a lot of things. So if I input a big string, it's going to try to read that big string. And we can see that this causes a crash if we do it. So if I have this program and I compile it in some way, it will crash. And if I compile it with our stack smashing detection protections disabled, which is what I'm going to be doing for all these examples until we talk about how those protections work, then, you know, this is what I see in a debugger. So in a debugger, it fails, it crashes at the end of vulnerable. And if we look at our backtrace, so this is our debugger trying to code the stack, our debugger says, oh, wait a moment. Well, I'm going to look at the return address, and our return address is this value, and this is an ASCII, it's just a bunch of A's. And the debugger tries to guess what the next return address is. And the way it does that is it just looks for, you know, assumes it's next on the stack without other information. So that's why this debugger gives us this stack trace, which is a bunch of the same thing. And we understandably had a seg fault because probably we were trying to return to this address and that's not valid memory, hence our segmentation fault. Questions about my debugger output here. So, to make better use of this idea, we're going to have to think about, well, what is on the stack? So, question here is, here's our assembly for our function. And I forgot. Sign there. My question is, is the buffer relative to the return address? And they're called a scanf. This is where the second argument comes in. So, and as a reminder of how call works, call is push return address jump. And I guess as a further reminder, push, you know, subtracts from the stack pointer. Give another 20 seconds or so. Have some variety of answers. Okay, so we have no majority answer for either question. Our plurality answer for both is 120 bytes after. So both of these can't be 120 bytes after buffer zero, because then we'd have two return addresses in the same place. And scanf is going to return to here. And vulnerable is going to return to something not shown on this slide. So they both can't be in the same place. They both can't have the same value. So where is it? Well, our buffer, we can tell at this point in the code, after this first subtract, is where the stack pointer is. So our stack pointer starts somewhere. We subtract 120 bytes. And then this is the location of the buffer, which we know because it's passed as an argument to scanf. Then we call scanf, and that pushes the return address onto the stack. So just before it in memory, because this is increasing addresses go up because we subtracted going down, is where it is. So here, this is just before, starting 8 bytes before, ending 0 bytes before. Okay, so that's where our return address for scanf is. As for where the return address for vulnerable is, well, we know that it's where we start. So it must be where our stack pointer initially pointed. So it's just 120 bytes above the buffer, beginning of the buffer. This might be a bit confusing because our buffer was declared with 100, but the compiler just decided to add some extra space. So questions? About my answers here.
What do you mean before and after, like, in related to what? Like, in relation to what?
So by before I mean a lower address, and after I mean a higher address. So notably, when we write our scanf writes its results, it's writing it going to increasing addresses, right? We start at 0, we go to buffer 1, buffer 2, buffer 3. I say buffer 1 is after buffer 0 using this convention. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So a question, would arg2 just be right after buffer on the stack? So what is... Oh, arg2, the second argument to printf, is never on the stack. It is just in this register EDI. And some code that's not shown here is that .lc0 is a constant string, and this code puts a pointer to that constant string into EDI. Does that answer that question? Other questions? So then question is, the buffer grows up in as I've drawn things, yes. Higher addresses are up, so yeah. The buffer grows to higher addresses, so it grows up, yes. Other questions?
The reason it's going up, right, is because of the add, is it because of the add queue? Is that why? Or I mean,
The reason it goes up is because when we give scanf the address of the buffer, we give it by giving it the address of buffer 0, and we expect it to write buffer 0, then buffer 1, buffer 2, and so on. Does that make sense?
Okay. Oh, you're saying literally you're going up and... Okay, I got you. Thank you.
Yeah. So we're just giving... Give the address of the buffer, we give the address of... The lowest part of it. Lowest address part of it. Okay. So I have a diagram prepared for this. So this is our memory layout. And if this means if we're thinking about what's the important thing we're overwriting, it's going to be the return address for vulnerable. There is a return address for scanf, but scanf is going to write going up this buffer. So we're never going to be able to write with this the return address to scanf. And in our demo, you know, I added a whole bunch of A's. So scanf wrote a whole bunch of A's and then kept writing A's and kept writing A's. And A's ASCII A is hex 6-1. So that's what happened. So the crash we saw was that we got to this return, and the return tried to jump to what was in the return address, which was invalid. So what are we going to do to actually make this useful? Is, well, we're going to point the return address to something interesting. Now, you might say, okay, so what could we point to that's going to be valid, that's not going to cause a seg fault? You know, and that's going to do what we as an attacker want, right? Because when we gave that simple buffer overflow last time, you know, we were like changing the grade or something like that. You know, how are you going to be able to run code that actually does something useful? Well, the way that the stack smashing pattern uses is it says, well, you know, we could provide that code. We could put it in the buffer even. So we can do everything all at once, and we just have to figure out where this part of the buffer is, and then we write the code in there. So we write the machine code we want to run, and then we write, you know, as part of overflowing the buffer, you know, we write over the return address the address of that part machine code in the buffer. So the question is, how do we figure out where the return address is? So if we're asking about how we figure out where this is located relative to the start of the buffer, some of you just did it by doing this exercise. You can read the assembly and figure that out. We also could do something like use the debugger, put in some pattern, and figure out what comes out here to, like, try to figure out, oh, if I put in this these characters, where do they end up? And those are all ways we could use to figure out exactly where this return address is. Probably the more the other question you might have been trying to ask, or some other people might have that we'll get to, is how do I figure out what this address is? And we'll talk about that in detail. That answer that question or follow-ups? Okay. So now that we know sort of what this stack smashing attack looked like, we're going to talk about how do we do this. And I'm going to divide this into three pieces. So we have one piece is that we need to write that machine code. We need to have machine code that we can put in the buffer or somewhere to run that does what we want. So how do we construct that? Part two is we have to identify where that is so we can overwrite the return addresses, and then we have to insert that return address in our buffer so it actually gets replaced. So I'm going to go through each part in turn. We're going to start with this first part. How do we write the shellcode? And this is something we've kind of already seen when we talk about how to write virus code, because we have many of the same challenges. We want this to work in any random executable. We're not going to have the luxury of being able to get the linker involved. And we probably aren't going to be able to continue running the application normally afterwards unless we're pretty careful, because we have overwritten the return value. So basically, when our code runs, probably we exit or otherwise terminate the application afterwards, because restoring the state of the application is tricky because we've overwritten important stuff. And we can use something like very similar to what we had for our virus code. So this is just from the tricky assignment. So here, in this case, I printed out a message. We could use the same strategy to do other useful things. And the name shellcode here is because often what we'll do is rather than printing out a message, we will make the OS request to run a shell. We're in a login shell. So we can type whatever commands we want. That is probably the most common thing to do. I'm going to show it where the task we're going to use is just writing out a message. But the same principles for constructing and apply, just rather than making the write system call, we would replace this, so if running a shell, we're going to replace with the execute application call. Application number. So there's a number here saying this is a write request to the OS, a write system call. There's another number we can make for executing an application. And that's what we do if we wanted to run a shell. And we could customize this for whatever task we want to perform. Now, in our virus code, we have the luxury of returning back to the application code. That's not going to work because we've overwritten all the return value. And if we try to do this return instruction, well, if we think about here, here's the return address that ran our code. So the stack pointer now points to here. And if we return again, we're going to try to return to whatever address is in this space here. So unless we've set that up, it's not going to be valid and this return would just crash. So if we're attacking a program, maybe we don't care about that. But if we do care, we can follow this same strategy of making specific requests to the OS to make another request to the OS. So in this case, here is how we make on Linux the system call called exit group, which is basically exit the current process. And the only reason that the reason why we can't do call exit is because we don't know where the exit function is. So this code here, this is the important part of what the exit function does. And we can look that up instead of, you know, running something else. So the question is, why would we bother exiting instead of segfaulting? So often you wouldn't, but this is demonstrate that we could make this stealthy if we wanted. That we don't have to have obvious signs that the program's been compromised. We can do whatever we want to do after we get control, and the attacker doesn't have to like show up if like you're monitoring for segfaults or things like that. So the question is, couldn't they tell it stop running? Yes. And if we cared about that, we could replace this with something which like restarts it or all sorts of other various things we might want to do. Does that answer that question? Yeah. Okay. And I'm pointing out sort of this doing custom operations to point out that, you know, we can make this code be whatever we want to do for the task at hand. So if we want to like print a string and exit, that's this example here, but we can use the same principles to construct any sort of task we want to do in the program. That the program could do. Okay, so then we get to, oh, and we also have to turn this into machine code. The same principle applies as with the virus code, and we have the nit that this needs to work at any location. So this is why I did relative addressing here, just like the virus code. That I need it to be the case that the, you know, the location of string is encoded as an offset. Because if it was encoded as the absolute location, then we need to do a lot of extra work to compute, oh, where is this string gonna be in memory? And we don't want to do that. Okay. Questions about this sort of inserted machine code? So the question is, string RIP forces the offset pattern, but it isn't actually adding RIP, right? Yes. So this syntax, like, it probably would make more sense if it was written string minus address of current instruction RIP, but it's basically equivalent to what you would think this would do. That in the machine code, you know, this turns into 15 because 15 hex because the amount of stuff here, this is 0x15 bytes. Got other questions? Okay, so we have our machine code. Now we need to figure out where is the actual memory address of the shell code in the buffer. So we want to know, where is the stack going to be? Okay. So basically, one way of thinking about this is that we're going to have an initial stack pointer. There's going to be a bunch of functions which are called to get to our vulnerable function. And we want to figure out where this is. So to make this practical, I'm going to assume for now that the initial stack pointer is at a fixed location. And you might surmise that one of the things you might do to make this sort of attack not work so well is not make this true. And we'll talk about that a bunch later. But if this is at a fixed location, which is certainly the easiest implementation and for a very long time was ubiquitously what was done, then we have our stuff written by the attack, and our code is going to be somewhere in here. You know, let's say it's, you know, a little bit after the start of this buffer is where we decided to put that machine code. We could have put it up here. We could have put it here. You know, it was our choice, but we know where it is in the stuff we're writing. And we want to figure out where that is. So one option is we can compute this distance. And we can do that without even running the program. We just read what main does, how it subtracts from the stack pointer, and every function in between. And we can just compute what this number is going to be. And that is a 100% valid strategy. But you probably wouldn't want to do that when we're doing the homework on this topic, because it's kind of annoying. It's a lot of stuff to read, and if you got the calculation off a little bit, it's pretty annoying. So something which maybe is more practical is that if we can just measure what the stack pointer is when the vulnerable function actually gets called, we can just compute this distance, which we already did that exercise. We said how far is the distance by reading the assembly, and that's much more tractable. It's a lot less code to be concerned with. So the question is, how can we measure this stack pointer at the start of vulnerable? Well, one way is we run it in a debugger. We just set a breakpoint, run, get to the beginning of vulnerable, when the stack before vulnerable decrements the stack pointer and allocates space, look up what the stack pointer is. There you go. And now you can compute the value that you're going to put in the return address. Questions about how I did this? So, what's going on here? Okay. And I think probably most straightforward is measuring the stack pointer at the beginning of vulnerable. We could also, like, try measuring it here when we call scanf or something like that, and the same idea would apply. So question, this is someone said comment, this is assuming the buffer is easy to go over. Yes, so we'll get into questions of what if there comes some constraints about this buffer later. First, let's do a little exercise here. So let's say here I have another overflow in this function here with this corresponding machine code. I'm asking, you know, I have my debugger output here, and I'm asking what should, where is that shell code that I put at the beginning of first? Okay, and I'll give another 15 seconds. And I think my comments have confused people because I didn't make it clear what they were referring to. Okay, so our priority answer is that it's the value we observed minus A0 plus 50. So let's start out with where this debugger stops. And this debugger, we set the breakpoint here, which we can tell because it output that, which is the first instruction of this function. So this means this is before the push happens. So we need to account for 8 bytes here to push RBX. Because that hasn't happened yet by the time we're seeing the stack pointer value. So this is one manipulation of our stack pointer, is that push. And the next manipulation is subtracting 0xA0 to allocate space for the two buffers in one go. Then there's two arguments to printf besides the constant string. The second one goes in RDX and first goes in RSI. So our first pointer is where the stack pointer is. So first is here. It's at the bottom of the stack after that A0. So this is first, and second is above it. And I think a lot of you were trying to get the address of the second because I put the comment above the assembly line and you assumed it would have been below. But our first is at the bottom of the stack here. So the correct answer, I believe, is minus 8 minus A0 to get to this location here, which is where our shellcode is. Which is the first answer, which not many people found. So questions on how I figured that out? Okay, so let's do in the opposite direction. Oh, I should have a none of the above option. That is unfortunate of me. But same idea, but rather than setting the breakpoint on vulnerable, I set it on in scanf, at the beginning of scanf. And oh right, and same question. Give another 20 seconds or so. Okay, so this blue arrow here, at that point, the place we want is right where the stack pointer is. Our breakpoint, however, is not there, but is after the, immediately after the call. And the call is going to push the return address onto the stack, which is 8 bytes. So we need to add 8 back to the stack pointer value we observe here. So this plus 8. Questions on how I got that? Okay, so this all assumes that our stack location is consistent, and I mentioned that, well, it's not. So if I like have a program here, I print out the location on the stack by passing a pointer to a local variable, which is going to be allocated on the stack to printf. And we can see it's different every time. And this is because there's a feature that's enabled by default in most modern systems that randomizes the location of most things in memory, called ASLR for address space layout randomization. And I can just disable that. And it used to be the case that this was disabled by default. And in fact, some programs would break if you enabled it, which is why it took a surprisingly long time for it to be default. But I can disable that, run a shell with that disabled, and now I get a consistent location. So it seems like if programs are running in this mode, that's great for the attacker, and that this would solve the problem. So we'll talk later about ways in which maybe this doesn't really solve the problem. That, yes, it's harder to deal with things when the stack location changes every time, but it's not always an issue. And probably the most obvious way in which this might not be an issue is that if our program started with this, we could compute the adjustment for the stack pointer. And that's sort of one idea you want to think about for why would this not be a problem. If we can ever get a value of the stack pointer somewhere leaked from the program or printed out legitimately, we can defeat that. And we'll think about that later. But for now, we're going to assume that the OS does the simple thing, starts it at the same location, and everything's great as far as this attack. And you might do that, and then you might experiment on Linux and say, okay, so let's try this. So I've disabled ASLR. This is, ASLR is disabled. So I said, okay, great, I've disabled it. Everything should be fine. And it's different in the debugger and outside. It's going to be consistent. If I run this again, I still get DE2C, I get the same output here, but in the debugger, it's different. And that seems awfully inconvenient. All right, and there's a question, is this because the debugger adds its own code to what's actually being run? Not exactly, we'll get to why in a second. And to get to why, I'll give another example of where we have an inconsistency that's gonna give us a hint. So, and that is going to be here. That if I run the program with arguments, it's consistent each time with the same arguments, but it changes depending on how I run it or also how I name the file name. So this is just the full path versus .slash. It's different. So what's happening here is that there's something on the stack I didn't account for, and that when I run a program in Linux, Linux puts the command line arguments to the program and also think something called the environment variables on the stack before starting main. So above, you know, so this is where main is below this. So at the top of the stack, even though that location is fixed, you know, depending on how many arguments we have and what their sizes are and how many environment variables we have, that's going to change where main starts. So a way we can deal with this is that, well, we can carefully control what this looks like, and we can, by configuring the debugger correctly, make this actually consistent with running it separately. And for the overflow assignment, I have very carefully written instructions on how to do that, just to lower the chance that tests are inconsistent. But in practice, the most common solution to this problem that attackers use is that, well, you don't actually need to get it right, exactly right. And a solution to this is that, you know, let's say here I have shell code. In this case, it's shell code that starts a shell. So this runs, this is a shell that's a command line. And this is execute it. And if I have this shellcode, well, I would need to compute the location of here. But instead, I can just say, put a bunch of nops in front of it. And then if I do that, I can guess this location or this location. I can just choose any of these locations as my return address, overwrite, and it will all work. So sort of what this looks like in an attack is that, you know, if we have a bunch of space before the return address, we just put a bunch of nops and the machine code, and now it doesn't matter if we end up pointing here or here, both will work. And if we wanted more space for this, if the buffer wasn't big enough, we could just put the nops up here. The nops up here above the return address if we wanted more space. And the machine code, of course. So that's the most common solution. This is sometimes called a nop slide. To make this actually work consistently. And so using this, we can have a lot of slack in what the return address can be. What the stack pointer can be, so we only need an approximation. And that also means that we can like kind of go back to our picture here, and well, if we want to compute this distance, if we only need to get it kind of right, like this might actually be a practical strategy. We can just like estimate. And notably, when we're doing this estimation, like this probably even still works if the functions are compiled slightly differently. We probably don't even need an actual copy of the exact binary we were attacking, as long as we know roughly what it looks like. Question is, don't we need to know the exact location of the return address? Yes, we do. We could, however, like take a bit of a shortcut in that something we could do here is we could write a bunch of copies of the return address that we want if we weren't sure. So we could like just have a few extra copies and just hope any one of them lines up. So we can do the same sort of strategy with the return address. We can just have a bunch of extra copies of it. So we don't need to exactly know where it is. Does that answer that question? Okay, so in the overflow assignment, we're going to use GDB. So to review, our typical pattern is like, if you want to figure out an overflow, we can like trigger a seg fault is often how you'd start doing this. Because, you know, yes, you can, I've told you so far, oh, here's where the vulnerable code is. You don't actually need to know that. You can just, you know, if you want to find these sorts of exploits, what people did is they just put too much input into the program and saw how it crashed. And when it crashed, they figure out, oh, it crashed on the return instruction. That must be where this is related to the overflow. And then they knew, here's the function. My debugger helpfully disassembled it for me when I told it to, that has that vulnerable code. And I also note for uses of the debugger that, you know, here I've shown doing it on a program where I can just disassemble the function and have it work. We can also work with, you know, if debugging symbols are removed, you can still disassemble things in the debugger. I'm not going to have you memorize this command because we'll have it on some sort of cheat sheet for you to figure out what's going on and like correlate this to the object dump output that we've seen that we can work with also. I guess some brief notes about debugger stuff that's useful for this is that in GDB, like I've shown setting breakpoints at functions, you can set breakpoints at arbitrary addresses. And notably, you could set this breakpoint on your inserted machine code. So after you do the overflow, you can like set a breakpoint in the machine code that you've inserted and debug what's going on with it. Which is sort of handy. And you can also set something called watch points. So for example, maybe you are trying to do this and yeah, you've tried the strategy of like having multiple copies of the return address and you still seem to be getting the wrong value in it. Well, something you can try to do is you can like use the debugger to figure out what's in the return address and you can set what's known as a watch point to ask, tell me when the return address is overwritten, like, and set something like a breakpoint there so you can look at the state of things just before then. You know, if you're worried about things being further messed up if you look until later. And sort of me talking about this debugger stuff is the preview of, you know, we're going to have you do this process of, you know, take some vulnerable program, trigger the crash, and work from there to figure out where's the return address, what am I going to overwrite it with, and so on. So I mentioned when I introduced this that this used to be probably the most commonly exploited flaw, and this was for a long time. So here I have an example of an actual version of this exploit that existed in the Morris worm. So the Morris worm was one of the, or maybe the first worm on the internet, so self-replicating malware. And the way it spread is through vulnerable, among other things, mail servers. And so basically you could send an email to a remote machine and overflow a buffer in the process. And this is how they arranged to overflow it. So this is constructing the buffer to send to the server as basically a mail header. So the author of the Morris worm carefully wrote some shellcode that ends up executing a command line. And what they would do is after this exploit ran, they would send to server commands to run in that command line. And we have the shellcode, and they knew that at 556 bytes and 560 bytes and 564 bytes was the frame pointer and the return address and so on. And they just set those explicitly to known values to make their shellcode work. Most notably, they included the return address being set in here to point to their where their shellcode would appear in memory. And whoever wrote the Morris worm just had a copy of the mail server program everyone was using at the time and carefully wrote this code to match the layout of the stack it used. Questions about this general setup? And as for the shellcode, well, this was for the VAX, so this is not x86 code, but it did something similar to what we've seen. It pushed the path to the shell program, which was binsh, onto the stack, made a pointer to that, and then made the OS call to run that program. Okay, so now that we have sort of the idea of how stack smashing works in our ideal case, we're going to start talking about some non-ideal things. We're going to wait to deal with the address space randomization issue until later, and we're going to first deal with some maybe more glaring problems with our first example. And that was, well, scanf %s, that can read 1,000 A's, but can it really read machine code into a buffer? And the answer is kind of. It matches a sequence of non-white space characters. So this means there are 5 different byte values we can use. And this isn't a problem, actually, for inserting machine code, because most of our machine code doesn't use, you know, the whatever these byte values end up being. I don't remember the actual number for tab, but like these are just particular bytes that can appear in our machine code, and usually we'll get lucky and they won't be there. But sometimes we won't be, and it might be an issue. And notably, and very fortunately, \0, like a null character, a byte with all zeros, is allowed in scanf. Scanf %s will read \0s. It seems hard to imagine how you'd use the \0s it would read in a legitimate program, but it reads them because the library is defined to do that in case you have a use for that. But you might imagine that maybe our defense for this is that just that all these string input functions shouldn't allow you to use null characters, because if we look at our machine code, gosh, do we have a lot of those. And, well, you might say, how do we avoid this? And if we look at why we have a lot of them, well, it's just that we wanted to encode constants and they contained a lot of zeros. So, can we avoid that? And the answer is yes. We just need to be more clever about how we write our assembly. So here's a version of the assembly where I've carefully avoided all of those zeros. So one thing I was worried about was this string here, which was offset. Previously, the offset was encoded as 00000015. For 15 bytes after. My solution, I put it before the LEA instruction and jumped over it. So it's now negative, so it's encoded as FFFFFF and something as a negative number, which doesn't contain any 0 bytes. I needed to deal with the moves here. So rather than moving one encoded as 00000001, I just did a one byte move, so it's a one byte constant, and use XOR to set the values to zero. And the net result of this is that I end up with shell code that, you know, doesn't actually contain any zeros. So I can do this by just thinking about other ways of writing all those instructions, and there's actually lots of options. So, like, if I didn't have this move instruction here, I could have used increment. I could have also used increment, you know, 37 times. You know, there's so many ways of having the same effect here that, you know, except for things like maybe syscall, I have tons of options. And even for syscall, I might have more options. There might be other ways of doing that. So we have this flexibility, but this is something we need to pay attention to. So a question, can the string be stored in the data segment of memory below the machine code? So we can put this string in all sorts of places, but it needs to be in the memory of the programmer running. And the only reason it's going to be in there is if it's in that stuff we overwrite. So we have to insert it into the program like we insert the machine code. So to do that, we don't really have a notion of a data segment. We have to decide some place to put it. So here I've put it in the middle of my machine code. I could have also placed it somewhere else in the buffer we're going to end up overwriting, but I need to place it somewhere in that buffer or somehow get it input into the program in some other way. So I have lots of options on where to put the string, but I need to choose, but it's not going to be this normal text data segment thing because this isn't normal program code that's loaded in the normal way. So I've shown you the strategy for avoiding zeros, and often there's lots of other things we'll want to avoid, and sometimes like this kind of comes up by accident. So for example, let's say you need the value 10 for something. You know, let's say the number of an OS call you want to make is 10. And 10 is OXA, which is a new line. That could be a problem. How do you get 10 without that? Well, you could just do something like set register to zero, increment it 10 times. And there's similar patterns for lots of things. And if you look carefully at this, people have figured out that, well, you know, x86 happens to work out that you can pretty much do anything you want with, as far as calculations go, like operating system requests, or you might need a specific instruction. But as far as like calculating values in registers, you can do pretty much anything you want with machine code that happens to correspond to normal ASCII characters. So if you were thinking, okay, we have this problem of people overwriting our buffers and inserting machine code into our applications, let's fix it by just filtering out that machine code, which is obviously binary data. Problem is that not all the machine code you want to filter out is binary data, and the attacker can probably make their machine code mostly or maybe completely not look like binary data for any filter you'd have. Now, you might say, okay, we can't filter in the the machine code part, but maybe we can deal with this return address part. Like, this is a very specific value, and, you know, we can filter the characters that are involved in that. So we'll look at that issue next. But first, a question. So why don't we edit the user input and just put a null byte at the max buffer size? So putting a null byte at the max buffer size wouldn't solve our problem. But the bigger issue is that the reason why we have this problem in the first place is because the function that's editing the buffer doesn't know the buffer size. So if we look at our original vulnerable code, the scanf function just doesn't know how big the buffer is. It just doesn't have a way of enforcing that constraint. Also, many other examples where you'd see this in practice, you won't have a function like scanf writing the buffer, but you'll have some code the application author wrote where they just didn't do the less than statement correctly. They forgot it. And that's sort of the most common cause of this problem. Okay. So I talked about avoiding weird characters in machine code. What about the pointers? The pointers seem like a problem. So for example, our buffer might be located at this address, and as bytes, we have to have, it looks like we have to have all these characters, and it looks like, okay, it looks like we need two zeros. Okay, so just filter out 0 bytes. We don't expect them in text input. You know, maybe that will work for text input. Wouldn't work for binary input, of course, but would work for text input. But this doesn't actually help us because the prior return address beforehand is probably something that ends with a bunch of zeros anyways, because like a normal return address is going to be something like, you know, 4073, which if we pad out to zeros has a whole bunch of leading zeros. So this probably doesn't help us. But you might say, what if these bytes are not allowed here? Well, our solution for that is instead of putting the machine code down here, we can just put it elsewhere in the buffer, like up here, that's going to have a different address for that. So we can just manipulate those lower bytes by just choosing a different place in the buffer or a different place on the stack that we're going to be able to write to. But it does seem like a real problem here for the attacker if we can't put an FF or a 7F in our input. That if the function that we're getting using to input doesn't expect text and not binary data, that it could filter out the 7F because it's expecting text. But commonly, this is not really a constraint. Now, we can't use the fully general pattern, but the reason we had a pointer to the stack here is because that's where we could easily put machine code. But maybe there's other places we can put machine code. So for example, here, I have a buffer overflow into the answer here, where I've constrained what characters I can put in. I can say it's alphanumeric or digits or period and space. You know, okay. And it seems like, okay, you can't use these characters to make a pointer to this buffer, even if you can write the machine code you want in these characters. But this isn't actually a problem very often because maybe we have some pointer that we can use those for. So let's say, for example, we have this global variable here, current student. And let's say it's at, you know, this is a typical address for a global variable. Well, that means that we can find a pointer to the middle of it that's in ASCII encoded with space, period, space. And this sort of scenario will often come up in real programs. So yes, it's more work for the attacker, but if we can find some global variable or something on the heap that has a pointer which doesn't have these forbidden characters, you know, that sort of filtering is not actually going to be an obstacle. Though, of course, the ideal situation for the attacker is that your input function, for some reason, doesn't filter out characters at all, you know, either because you use some very general input function like scanf with %s, or because like you're expecting binary data like, you know, an image or something like that. So that's where I'm going to leave off. I think we nicely finished that. And next time, we're going to talk about ways of stopping stack smashing that are, you know, seem like they're going to like fix this problem. And we're going to talk about sort of the pros and cons of one of those approaches and look at sort of other types of overflows that that's going to bring to mind when we realize, oh, there are things this doesn't protect against. That's where I'll leave off today. So take questions before I sign off.